Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, Michael.
Good to see you.
Good to see
Long
you
day today.
Long day.
Yeah, I mean, we started at 10:30, you're here 11.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really not that long of a day, but we do so much talking and things that it feels like a really long day.
Oh, I'm going to be tired when I leave, yeah.
Oh, I'll be tired. I'll need a nappy napperoo.
A little nappy nap?
Yeah.
A little nippy nap?
Great guest today. Before we get into it, if you're here just for Billy D. Williams, you don't know who I am. You don't know the podcast. You don't care. I urge you, I just ask if you like the podcast, you enjoy it, follow me and write a review and hopefully support this little podcast Inside of You. I really appreciate it. Our handles are at Inside of You Podcast on the Facebook and Instagram, at Inside of You Pod on the Twitter. If you go to my Instagram at the Michael Rosenbaum in my link tree, you'll see cons that are coming up, conventions with me and Tom Welling and Smallville Nights. We're doing a live podcast in May, which will be on there soon, and tons of other stuff. You can go to the Inside of You online store if you want cool merch, like Smallville ship keys and Lexmas scripts signed by me and Funko Pops and a bunch of other cool stuff. Quickly, it's also on my Instagram, but on my link tree, Rosie's Puppy Fresh Breath, new product. If you want your dog's breath to smell good, well, Rosie's Puppy Fresh Breath on Amazon. Get it. It's odorless, tasteless. You just put it in your dog's water. Boom. It's that easy. So if you want to support that, there's also a little picture of me and my doggies on there. And last but not least, thank you to all the patrons who support this podcast, patreon.com/insideofyou. If you want to join and support the podcast and give back, you're what keep the show going. I'll send you a message and there's so many fun perks. So check out patreon.com/insideofyou. We've got a great episode today, Ryan.
We sure do.
Yeah. He came into the house. He was sitting right where you are.
I know.
Billy D. Williams, Lando Calrissian. And he was epic. You are going to love this episode, hopefully as much as I did. And Ryan, he took pictures with us. I could tell in the beginning, he was like, what am I doing? Who's this guy? I've never seen him before. I don't know Inside of Me or Inside of You. And I could tell I slowly got him to warm up. Like he started to like me. I felt like, I think he likes me now. I think he says, okay, this guy's all right. He's got a sense of humor. And I think he liked me. Maybe he thinks I was an asshole. I don't know. I really, really appreciated having him here. And he was just such a gentleman, so articulate, friendly, talks about his new book and so much more. You want to get this book too, The Inside Story of Billy D. Williams. And without further ado, let's get inside of the legend, my hero, Billy D. Williams.
It's my point of view. You're listening to Inside of You. Michael Rosenbaum.
Our house is a mess. Come on in.
I'm Amber Wallen, internet comedian and host of your new favorite podcast, Fly on the Wall.
Okay, that's pretty presumptuous to assume that this is going to be their favorite podcast, by the way.
Anyway, that wasp that you just heard interrupt me is my husband.
And co-host, Benjamin Wallen.
Listen in as we discuss relationships and keeping our sweet baby kid alive.
Fly on the Wallen, wherever you listen.
Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum was not recorded in front of a live studio.
Well, this is certainly a dream to have you in the studio. It is. Why you laugh? You've done 70 films, over 70 films, and TV and Broadway. You're an accomplished artist. You have work in the Smithsonian. I mean, I have every right to be enamored.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate that.
Yeah. This is fantastic.
The first thing you said in here, you said, which I don't know how I believe it. Maybe artists, maybe are like this because you're a real artist. You said you're disorganized.
Yeah. I think that's a secret to my success.
Really?
Disorganization.
So I'm OCD, so everything has to be in place.
Well, I'm a walking absurdity. So
why? What do you mean?
Well, I don't know. It's a kind of a whimsical kind of a bit of tacit humor, I guess, that I sort of rely on, I guess, for most of my life.
So you don't care if something's out of place or...
Not really, no. I think you can learn a lot from things being out of place. Probably more than you realize.
Yeah, my therapist tells me that as long as your life is organized around you, then you can do your work. You can focus if it's everything's a mess.
Well, that's why I surround myself with people like Marcy.
And you've been with the same woman pretty much since 72.
Oh, Marcy and I have known each other over what? How long, Marcy?
38 years,
yeah.
Yeah, 38 years, she's been with you.
Yeah, she's a wonderful human being.
Well, you look fantastic. Do you always, is that something since, was inside you since you were young? Did your mother instill that on you where you look good when you go out? You look nice.
Well, they were pretty fashionable people, my mother and my father and my grandmother and the people I come from. I always remember one thing. I was talking about it the other day, as a matter of fact. I was saying about my mom and dad. Mommy and daddy were always very fashionable. They always tried to... I had a twin sister, a lady. And they always kept us looking presentable.
Yeah.
And even when they had shoes that had holes in their shoes and they had to put paper in there, in the holes.
To make it look like there's no hole?
Yeah.
To fill it up?
To fill it up, yeah.
Wow.
Well, we all grew up in New York City, so there's obviously a lot of inclement weather, snow and rain and stuff like that. But anyway... they were, I think, even Mother's Day, I talk about it in the book, as a matter of fact, and Mother's Day was always the, corsage, the little flowers and all that sort of stuff. So we were very, conscious of that kind of, it made us, my sister and I, very conscious and aware of, the whole idea of looking, being presentable, so to speak.
I love that you were so worldly. It feels like your family instilled, whether it's acting or art or all these things, that was always going on in your house?
Well, I come from a very creative background. I was never a thug. I was always a product of a lot of creativity. My life has been an eclectic life, at a very early point in my life. I mean, to be on Broadway at the age of six and 7 years of a Kurt Weill musical with La Reina. I mean, at that stage in my life, I mean, it was a kind of an experience. I think most people don't have,
nobody has that.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't imagine at 7 years old, you're on Broadway. I mean, were your parents sort of very loving and,
Oh, they were wonderful.
See, I like hearing that.
They were wonderful people. If I have to come back to this life again, I would want those people to be my parents, and I want my father, mommy, daddy, grandmommy, and lady. Those are the four people that have shaped my life. So,
wow. Yeah. And how so? I mean, how did they shape your life? What was it about them?
Well, they were just wonderful human beings. And certainly my grandmother, who was from the British West Indies, who never became an American citizen, always remained a British subject. And she used to sit around the house singing, "Rule Britannia, Britannia, rule the waves. Britain never never shall be slaves. So you got that aspect.
Right.
And then, of course, you got my father's side, which was all from Texas, cowboys. And
wow.
And interesting. They were all very interesting people. I would say that my family were eccentrics.
I was just going to say, sounds very eccentric. My family, we weren't eccentric at all.
And my sister, my sister was brilliant. She was a straight-A student from the very beginning of school until college. And she ended up working for, at that time, AT&T, and invested money and stuff like that. I mean, she was a pretty bright human being. You're extraordinary people, actually. They're progressive people.
I look at you and I feel like, wow, how lucky. Because a lot of people don't have that, that unconditional love.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think that's...
And we grew up around what they called at that time the black bourgeoisie. These very prominent people who were raising their children to meet the right people and have cotillions and all that sort of stuff.
Really?
Those are the kind of people I grew up around.
Well, when you dated someone, was your mom, were your parents, did they say if they liked her or not? Were they very vocal about
that?
Well,
they were from like my girlfriend, Sandra Day, who her father was, I think, a principal of a school. And they were always looking. I was always sort of like Brando was my hero. And, I kind of lived my life in this kind of maverick way, while everybody was dressing up for cotillions and stuff like that. I would show up in a ragged jacket, stuff like that.
Why was that, you think?
I was I just felt like I didn't want to
be like them.
I didn't want to be like them. No.
And, you get into acting at such a young age. And I just had an actor who's going to play the next Lex Luthor. And we're talking about, he started at like 3 or 5. And, he came from a family where everybody was acting and doing these things. But it seems like you started, especially after you get Broadway. Are you then sort of, you have the bug? You just love it?
Well, yeah. My mom took me for the audition. She was working as an elevator operator and then became a secretary. And she was working at the Lyceum Theater for Ben Boyer and Max Gordon. They were managers, Broadway managers and producers. And they were doing this musical, and they needed a little boy. A cute little boy, and I was a cute little boy.
Of course.
And so I went and auditioned. They had me walk across stage one time, two times, and I liked it so much I wanted to do it the third time. And they said, Billy, no, that's okay. And I started crying. So I always say I cried my way into show business. But that's how it, at that particular moment, I never felt I looked for to be an actor. I never looked for anything, really. I mean, things sort of just came my way. And every time I thought I felt like I should go right, something would say, no, Billy, go left. I remember reading a book, Catching a Rye.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that boy was me, always on I'm sort of living this adventure. So, I was sort of with a kind of, I guess, an innocence. A kind of naivete.
Yeah.
I would always sort of just find myself in situations that, and I'm always curious,
Are you still that way?
Yeah, I'm still that way.
You're like, still curious about things?
Yeah. I'm like a sponge. I'm always interested. I don't really even, the whole idea of sitting here and talking about myself, I really don't really enjoy that.
Oh, great. No, I love it. I'm glad you came because it's just what this is, this podcast is, sort of we talk about real things, about real life, about how we face adversity, how we deal with mental health, and so a lot of these big actors that come in. But, well, it's and like for me, I come from dysfunction. So, of course, I need therapy. I go to therapy. It really helps. And my whole life, I didn't realize I was such an anxious person and all this because of my environment.
Well, I think we all need therapy.
Have you gone to therapy?
I've never gone to therapy.
Not once.
Well, I mean, life is therapy to me.
Well, how do you learn from your mistakes? Are you just that good at saying, okay, I won't do that again?
I think for the most part, yeah. I'm not an addictive personality or anything like that. So I can let go of things when I find that it doesn't work.
And you always had this love for art.
Yeah, always. Yeah.
I mean, more so than acting?
No, life is art. Living is art. Just existing is art. How one differentiates is, I don't know that I've really spent much time doing that. Maybe I should have.
Well, you're not someone who dwells. You're not someone who has one foot in the past, one foot in the future, and kind of pisses on the present, as my therapist once told me.
No, it's too much work.
Really?
Yeah.
When you started into the business, I know you were frustrated. I read about that, where you were frustrated with sort of like, you know, the roles you were getting and things that, you know, because Hollywood was different and they weren't giving opportunities to black people. And it was just probably incredibly frustrating.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, but I don't dwell on things like that. You know, I don't really care about stuff like that. I know I do what I want to do, and I think I'm creative enough to figure out how to. I'm always looking for a way to make things unique. So I don't spend my time feeling like a victim.
Most people do.
Yeah, most people do, but I'm not one of them. You know, I'm just not. For me, it's like, okay, if there's an obstacle, then I'll figure a way to get around it or through it.
Yeah.
But I'll do it in a way that gives me the advantage, at least to some degree.
Yeah.
You know, for me, it's being innovative and the challenge and the fun. To me, is to try to figure out how to do things in a way that most people are not used to seeing or witnessing in their daily lives.
Yeah, you seem like someone who never was really affected by the business. You didn't let it eat you up.
No, not at all.
You loved it.
Yeah, I mean, listen, it came to me, and it's been good to me, and. You know, and it never stopped me from living. As a matter of fact, I found myself involved with people that I would, you know, that normally you wouldn't be involved with. I mean, you end up working with people like a Paul Muni, one of the great actors this country's ever produced, Luther Adler, you know, people from the Yiddish theater. You find yourself working with Joni Plowright and having
I worked with her.
I
had a little scene with her. She was really sweet.
Really?
Joan Plowright,
yeah,
Laurence Olivier's wife.
Yeah,
actress.
Right. Yeah,
yeah, she was lovely.
Yeah, and we did A Taste of Honey together on Broadway. And you find yourself working with Angela Lansbury, spending time with Olivier. I spent a lot of time, you know, talking with Laurence Olivier.
Really?
What
do you talk about with Laurence Olivier?
Well, I mean, I remember the first time I met him, I was really enamored with him, and I didn't know what to say to him, so I ran out, you know, I just walked up to him and gave him a kiss on the cheek, and he just got a big kick out of that.
Really?
In the meantime, I was always busy flirting with Joni.
She gorgeous in her prime?
Joni was never really gorgeous. I just saw her on Instagram the other day. I couldn't believe how she's like an old person who's as hard of hearing.
She's on Instagram?
But she and Maggie Smith.
Wow.
And it was another great English actress, and they were complaining about Judi Dench. They were complaining that Judi Dench was being given all of the roles, and then nobody was choosing them for these roles that Judi Dench ends up with. But anyway, I thought it was quite amusing. And Joni is sitting and going, What? she didn't understand what they were talking about. So it was pretty amusing. I asked Olivier if, you know, the beauty of Olivier was that as a kid, I was 23 years old at the time. I mean, and I had a lot of questions, you know.
As an actor.
As an actor, as a person.
Right.
But certainly as an actor, you know. And the one thing I learned about Olivier was that, he would let me ask questions. He was always asking me questions. He was always probing me. And I kept saying, and I thought, my God, why this guy is as good as he is. Because he's not busy trying to show the world, you know, showing off the fact that he's Laurence Olivier. But, you know, he was a very...
He's learning from each human he meets.
Yeah.
He wants to learn something
from
you.
Yeah, he wants
you.
To learn, yeah. He was one of those kind of performers, I think, he was criticized in his career because he was, you know, he was not from the school, what they call the Edmund Kean School of Acting. You know, Gielgud was more like that. You know, from working from the neck as the neck up,
right?
Your words. You know,
he was more about what the body. Everything.
But he was more physical,
right? Physical.
Yeah, and he would always be criticized because he would do these crazy things on the stage, and people were criticizing him for it. It was like Rachmaninoff. Those kind of guys I love. They come along and they just do things that they just break all the rules.
Unconventional.
Yeah. So, but anyway, I asked one day, I said, had you ever thought about playing Othello? And he said, yeah, I thought about it. But when I think of Othello, he was saying, when I think of Othello, I think of Paul Robeson and Robeson's voice and his stature. And interestingly enough, when he did finally take on the role of Othello and it was videotaped, I don't know if you've ever seen it. But it's really quite interesting, his performance. And he deepened his voice, and he went through that process. And also, when he walked around, he stuck his ass out and walked around with his ass, because black people are supposed to have big asses, right?
Are they?
And when I saw it, I fell out laughing. I thought it was hysterical because he had the courage to do stuff that broke all the rules.
Yeah.
You know, which made it all the more fascinating to watch him.
Did you feel like that in your career? Do you feel like you were trying to do that?
Yeah,
that was always
the kind of actor I was. I was always trying to break rules, trying to make, for me, it was always about heroics. And a vulnerability.
Yes.
Vulnerability was always very important to me. If you want to make a really interesting hero.
Do you want him to be liked?
Yeah, you want him to be liked. Cagney. G. Robinson.
Yeah.
They were all liked. And I said, they're liked because there was something about them. Well, first, Cagney always had his ma. That was one. Betty Davis. She was always like
my favorite.
She could create hell.
Yeah.
But you loved her. You wanted to, in fact, you wanted to see her create hell.
What, like whatever happened to Baby Jane?
Yeah.
Like you're watching her and you're like, oh my gosh, she's crazy. She's evil. And then you see these little nuances.
But it's like an exercise.
Yeah.
You know, what's his name? The English actor who's a brilliant actor. He's like a carpenter.
What's his name from My Left Foot and Lincoln? Yeah. Daniel Day-Lewis.
Is that...
You love him.
Yeah. Yeah. He breaks rules. He gets so locked into what he does, he scares himself.
America starts the day with America in the Morning.
First of three pushes of storminess.
Hi, I'm John Trout, your host for the latest news, politics, entertainment, business, and weather.
A speech with political overtones.
Our staff of correspondents provide a fast-paced look at the world with specialized reports from where news happens.
The judge's decision was based on finding there is a likelihood.
So far, the central bank appears to be threading that.
Concise, accurate, and fresh each day.
America in the Morning, the podcast, available wherever you listen.
Did you ever scare yourself?
Oh, yeah.
When did you scare yourself?
Well, I played, there was one character I played, well, a couple of them. One character, I did a play called Slow Dance on the Killing Ground, Randall. And I fell in love with Randall. Randall's a crazy. He was, his character was based on a kid, a Puerto Rican kid, who was running around New York City with an umbrella with a spear on the end of the umbrella. And they finally caught up with him. I think he killed his mom. Anyway, William Hanley, who wrote the Slow Dancing on the Killing Ground, he wrote this play about, it was about three people actually, but this kid was one of the characters. And I really got caught up with that character. Clarence Williams actually did it on Broadway first. I did it off Broadway. Then I went up to Toronto and did it for CBC television.
Are you someone who sometimes watch a performance and say, what can I do differently?
Yeah, you know, bigger than life is always a big thing with me.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
it's okay to dwell on all of these realities that we find ourselves mired in, you know, like prejudice and bigotry and all that kind of stuff. But that's not important to me. What's important to me is, you know, I got really friendly with Paul Muni when I did my very first movie. The Last Angry Man. And he and I used to spend a lot of time talking. And one of the things we always talked about is that, you know, no matter what, I mean, no matter who you are, you should be able to play. If you're an actor, you should be able to play any character you want to play, no matter who you are, what your ethnicity,
right,
and all that.
Because you're acting.
Yeah. You know, that's the challenge, is to convince people that you're something that you're really not, but you really are.
You know, if I play a tough guy or crazy, I have to just make it believable and play that.
Yeah, right.
And you have to take chances.
Well, like Jack Palance, I met him one time and we got to be friends a little bit. I mean, that guy was one of the on-screen scariest people in the world when you met him. Or like Dick Butkus. He was
Bears.
Yeah. He would destroy people on the football field, but wrote poetry, you know.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that about Dick Butkus. Yeah.
It's like, you know, when you meet a boxer, a fighter, and you shake his hand, I'm always surprised how soft their hands are. But you're looking at a hand that can devastate you.
Right.
I mean, I don't know if I'm explaining myself.
No, you are. You are. It makes perfect sense.
But I mean, juxtaposition kind of stuff, you know.
Mike Tyson said, Ali. Yeah. Mike Tyson said in an interview I just watched. I don't do a good Tyson, but they said, he goes, when you get out there, what are you thinking? What do you think? He goes, I don't like myself. He's like, what do you mean you don't like yourself? He goes, the person I become, I don't like that person.
No, I've seen him talk about
that. Yeah, he's like, I don't like that person. I like to be. So in other words, when he's not fighting, when he's not getting into that mode.
Yeah, that duality. Yeah.
Yeah. Were you someone who could just drop it like that if you're playing a role?
Well, I fell in love with one character I did. It was a jazz, because I love jazz and grew up around jazz. And I spent a lot of time with people. My wife, for instance, her ex-husband, well, he's dead. He just died recently. Was Wayne Shorter. But I love spending time around like Herbie and those guys, Joe Zawinul when he was alive. I love that energy, that kind of energy. But anyway, there was one character I played, Slate Thompson, and I used to talk like that. Yeah. Hey, Arvo. You know, and I fell in love with the guy. I wanted to be that character forever. I wanted to be
him. You would talk like that even when it was over?
Yeah, right. I was like, I really got caught up with this character.
Did someone tell you, hey, stop doing that? Or no?
Not that I remember. but, you know, every now and again you run into, you know, certain situations and certain characters. You're an actor, obviously. So you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, for me, it's always about you know, experience, life experience. It's about, I remember how, you know, someone in my life treated me, and I'm going to use that. And I'm going to use that anger.
Yeah.
And it pays off, especially when it's coming from a real place. So experience is the number one thing for an actor, I think. I think if they...
But you got to learn to let it go, too. You know, you can't just, you know, be that character.
No, I couldn't. I played that guy for 7 years, Lex Luthor. Right here, the statue.
Oh.
Right here.
Oh, okay.
So I was the bad guy, but trying to be good. But I sometimes would channel the anger and channel the emotions. Mm. And, you know, I think everything I do, it's always been coming. It came from something. So I appreciate, although I wish I had your childhood, at the same time, maybe I became successful because of certain things that I grew up with.
Yeah, well, listen, my whole life was not rosy by any stretch.
What wasn't rosy about it?
Well, I mean, you know, it's what all of us go through, you know, when we journey through this barren sod, this veil of tears.
Yeah. Loss. You've dealt with a lot of loss.
Yeah, you know, there are those moments of great doubt, great moments when you really feel like, you know, fuck it, I'm going to commit suicide. Get the fuck out of here.
You thought about that?
Yeah.
Really? So, you got that dark?
Yeah.
And how did you get out of that?
You meet somebody and you fall in love. And romance got me out of it.
Oh, man. I mean, that's dark. I mean, I've had thoughts like that where I'm driving and I'm like, well, if my car goes over a bridge, I, you know, so be it. You know, and I'm like, why are you thinking like that? Oh my God, you know, you got, you know, and you try to reevaluate yourself and where does it come from and how do I fix this?
Well, that's okay as long as you're learning from it, right? I mean,
yeah,
you know, as long as you don't do it.
Yeah. You know, you are smooth. Like, you're 86 years, 7 years old?
Yeah, I'll be 87 in April.
87. Yeah. And, you know, everybody always talks about how you're the smoothest man. And
really?
And into this conversation now, I see why. Without you having to do anything, you're just innately smooth.
Well, that's very kind of you.
I mean,
I don't really spend any time thinking about it.
Well, that's exactly why it is, because you don't think about it. People that are smooth don't think about being smooth.
Well, I just think of myself as the absolute idiot of all time. You know, maybe that's a good thing.
Why?
Well, first of all, you don't take yourself that seriously. Yeah. You take your work seriously, but you don't take yourself seriously.
Yeah.
My favorite actor, one of my favorite actors of all time, Marcello Mastroianni.
Really?
I loved him.
What was it about him that you loved?
He was one of those kind of heroes, I think, that he was never certain. And he would get involved in situations, dilemmas, and try to figure out how to get out of it. He'd managed to get out of the dilemma. But it was always getting back to that. It's the vulnerability.
It is. It is. I think you have to have that or it doesn't work as an actor.
Yeah.
In Lady Sings the Blues, and then, I mean, working with Diana Ross, by the way.
Oh, great. We had a lot of fun. We were like two little kids.
I mean, that had to be, and did she get the choice to pick you?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. You know,
did you meet with her at first?
Yeah, we met when they had me come in audition. And
she read with you?
Yeah, I think she did. I think, as I recall, we did a screen test together. I was the worst, terrible.
You were terrible?
I was terrible.
But you got the part, so how terrible could you have been?
Because Berry Gordy had a keen sense of what works and what doesn't work. And he saw the chemistry between Diana and me.
You were attracted to each other.
You know, we were having so much fun. We were like little kids, you know, during the screen test. And he ran up to me after I did the screen test. And, you know, he's a wonderful man. In his wonderful, whimsical way, he ran up, Billy, you are Louis McKay. I just got to talk to these people, you know, the people he worked with, his team. And he says, but you are Louis McKay. You know, so he saw the
chemistry.
The chemistry.
Wow, isn't that something? Because they say when an actor walks into a room when he starts talking, they're like, they know right away. And you're saying you went in there. It didn't matter anything you said.
Well, he thought I was a ridiculous human being when I first, you know, because I had forgotten my glasses when I did the reading the first time. And I had a difficulty seeing the words. And he thought I was being a bit arrogant. And but he got a big kick out of it. By the way, when I did that character, it was right in the same year I had done Gail Sayers and Brian's Song.
Let me tell you something. That Brian's Song is one of my all-time favorites. It is the best performances. It's like a love story between two non-gay men. There's so much heart that I remember watching it in high school in English class. They made us watch it. And I had ADHD. I couldn't focus on anything. And I was right there.
Yeah.
And I remember crying and trying, as I knew the bell was approaching, how to get those tears, like, stop, stop, stop trying to make yourself stop crying. It was so emotional. I always tell people that they need to see that.
Again, it's a kind of a provincial myopic kind of thinking that occurs that prevented those guys from giving us the Academy, from giving us Emmys. We were nominated.
Yeah.
But they couldn't figure out whether to give it to me or give it to Jimmy. And I'm sure it was all based on this whole racial thing. So they gave it to some English actor for his performance in, what was it, Six Wives of Henry VIII. And I thought, wow, man, Jesus. And the whole world, the whole country, they fell in love with this experience.
That really, in a lot of ways, really your career took.
Yeah, for years people have, even to this day.
To this day.
It was an act of love, that experience.
And you got along with Jimmy Kahn?
Oh, yeah. He and I are not the kind of two people to hang out with each other, because Jimmy is, you know, he's a whole different kind of person. Tough guy, you know.
You're not a tough guy?
No.
Never been a tough guy?
No.
A lover, not a fighter?
No, yeah. I'm not into violence and fighting and bickering and all that sort of stuff.
You ever lose your cool on set?
No.
Not once.
No. I would hear stories about how people were having difficulty with each other and stuff like that. And I'd say, really? I didn't even take notice most of the time, all of the time.
That's probably why you've done over 70 films. People want to work with you.
I guess. I don't know.
I think it has something to do with it. I have to mention Nighthawks because it's another movie I love.
Yeah.
I love Nighthawks.
That was a good movie.
I mean, it was a great movie. That ending where he's in the kitchen, where he's dressed up as a woman.
I was supposed to do that role.
Really?
Yeah, but I refused to do it.
Because you didn't want to dress up like a woman?
I didn't want to dress up like a woman.
Really? Oh, no. That's hilarious.
So Sly's decided to do it.
Yeah, look, I'll do it. If you don't want to dress like a woman, I'll do it.
Was he fun to work with?
Oh, yeah, we had a good time.
You ever talked to him since then?
Well, yeah, at the gymnasium when Gunnar Peterson.
Oh, yeah.
I used to work out with Gunnar. When he's now in Tennessee. He moved.
Yeah.
But Sly was always there, and so was Jimmy.
You don't have any stories about Sly, working with Sly?
Well, I mean, only Sly was always in great, fantastic condition.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm 10 years older than Sly. And when I told him how old I was and I was keeping up with him, he was a little bit amazed. But I used to say, look, could you do me a favor? Could you just slow down a little bit, please?
Hey, look, so I can, all right.
So I can look good.
Yeah. Oh, man. Look, I know you talk about this so much, but I mean, I have to bring it up because, I'm a diehard Star Wars fan, too. But it was the first significant black actor in a Star Wars franchise, right? Lando Calrissian.
Yeah, I guess that's what everybody tells me. I don't know.
Did you audition for this?
No. I was asked to play the character.
George called you.
Well, I was on the contract to Berry Gordy
right.
for 7 years. And I guess they got in touch with Berry and...
George?
Shelley Berger, who was my manager, who was working for Berry. They all worked everything out.
Was it a no-brainer?
Yeah, it was a no-brainer. I mean, it was one of those things. Well, I had all of the charm and good looks that everybody wanted.
But also, what you were talking about earlier is you like to be larger than life. You like to be, you know, and that character had that and the vulnerability.
Yeah, you know, when they told me his name, Lando Calrissian, and I said, Calrissian, wow, that's interesting. Let me see what that Armenian name, wow, okay, let me see what I can do with that one. You know, it was a departure. It was like I didn't go, I just went the opposite way. I didn't do the whole, you know, okay, George told me that the reason why they had me come in was because into this whole situation was because he was getting a lot of flack about Darth Vader being this big black figure, you know. And so he had to kind of clarify that whole situation, you know, because all he was thinking was the old cowboys syndrome, where the guy in the black hat and the guy in the white hat, that's what he was thinking about.
Right.
But when I got that role, I said, Calrissian, well, let me see what I can do with it. And then when I got the cape, I said, whoa, yeah. I said, Errol Flynn.
You love the cape.
Oh, man, it was fantastic. I mean, the combination of Calrissian and the cape set the tone for me.
Did you ever keep any props?
Well, the only thing I got out of that was a Wookiee head.
A Wookiee head?
Yeah.
You have a real Wookiee head?
Yeah.
At your house?
Not anymore. Yes.
What'd you do with it?
It's put away somewhere.
Oh, you do have it?
Yes.
Because I always keep shit from sets. Something.
Yeah. Well, I got lots of little things, you know, I don't know. But I don't even remember what they are.
Do you remember your first day filming? It had to be nerve-wracking. You're in a huge movie.
Well, you know, Empire Strikes Back, we're working with Irv Kershner, whom I had tremendous admiration for.
Unbelievable. Could be the best one of the franchise, Empire, a lot of people say.
Oh, I think it is.
I do, too.
In my opinion.
Yeah. It's just unbelievable what they did with the effects. Were you nervous?
Yeah, a little bit, I think, because I was new. And I was... around people who had established a whole family, and here I was the new guy, and I'm not a very I'm not an easy I don't walk into situations very easily.
How so?
I'm just very shy, and
you don't talk to people unless they talk to you.
Yeah, I'm just sort of very reticent. I'm a private person, and I don't hang out, you know.
Really?
No.
You just do the work and go home?
I'll do the work and then I'll go home. That's it, yeah.
And the people that you worked with, like Harrison and Carrie was a good friend of mine, Carrie Fisher.
Oh, she was fantastic.
Carrie. I bet she was fun on set.
Well, she and I had a lot of fun. We always used to talk a lot. And she's, what a brilliant child that she was.
Really?
You know. The last time I saw her, as a matter of fact, I was having, at Petrosian, I was having some caviar with my good friend, Tapa Schroeder, who owned Gendarme, who also passed away. Everybody's passing away.
I know, gosh. I know. But Carrie Fisher, that was the last time you saw
her? Yeah, she happened to be, came by, which was picking up some caviar, and we talked for a little bit. And
it was yesterday?
Yeah.
She's like that. I could just hear her, Billy, and then get out. She's just, yeah, she just.
She was a delight.
Delight. She used to tell me anytime I'm in the area to stop by her house, here's the code. I still remember the code. And I go in. She goes, make yourself a sandwich, whatever. And sometimes I hear her on the speaker. Rosenbaum, is that you? I'm like, yeah. What are you doing? I'm making a sandwich. Make me one. You know, I mean, she was just. It was amazing because
brilliant mind.
That's the thing. Sometimes I'd have to stop and go, I don't know what the fuck you're talking about. She goes, all right, look, here's what I'm saying. You know, because she would go on these tangents where I was like, you know, she would tell me about her fights with Paul Simon when they were married. And sometimes he would say the most brutal but brilliant things that she'd say, excuse me for 1 second. She'd run in the other room and she'd write down what he said to her so she could remember it and maybe write it later because she thought it was so genius. She got me into writing. I'm surprised. Were you inspired at all by her to do your book?
No, well, I started out, I've always been writing a little bit here and there.
Tell me about your book, What Have We Here? Why did you feel like you wanted to do this?
Well, again, I was thinking in terms of a legacy. And I've had such an interesting life that I thought people, and I know there are an awful lot of people who have liked me and supported me throughout the years and who are curious about my life. And I thought, well, this is time. And I'm at that age now where it would be fun for people to know what I want people to know that not that I'm not being critical, but I just want people to know that sometimes there's something a little bit more than just feeling like a victim.
It's inspirational.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love that.
Originally, I wanted to do my life story based on my paintings.
Yeah.
I wanted to do a coffee table book, which I'm still going to do.
You absolutely should.
But I decided about 2.5 years ago to really, I started thinking in terms of legacy, you know, stuff like that. I guess what happens when you get to be an old man.
Yeah, I was thinking, I was like, is it something when the older you get, you start thinking about, well, how many years do I have left? Or do you?
Yeah.
You do?
Yeah.
How often do you think about that?
All the time.
Really?
Yeah.
What do you think about?
Lately, I've been thinking about it a lot.
Like dark stuff?
No, it's not dark. It's, you know, it's inevitable. You know, what did G. Robinson say when in Little Caesar? I always use that phrase, Mother of Mercy, is this the end of Rico?
So you have a sense Mother of humor Mercy. About it.
Yeah, I have a sense of humor about it.
I mean, yeah, I wonder, because I think about it now. It's all of a sudden, what happens is it goes by so fast. I know it's cliche, but it all of a sudden you're in your 20s and then boom, I'm 51 and I'm like, wow, how did that many years get by? It seems like such a long, long time ago. And being 87, going to be turning 87, you know, but you don't have a fear of it.
Well, I'm not going to say I don't have a fear of it. I mean, it's, the whole prospect, you know. The whole thing to me, I'm always curious about, you know, the fact that you get born, you live, and then you're out of here.
See ya. That's true. Know,
it's a curiosity to say the least. The fact that you're like a frequency, you're a wave.
Yeah. You know. Yes, I know. I just wish dogs lived longer. But I love this where they said you found LSD and you said it saved your life and it let me get inside of myself. Otherwise, you're an anti-drug. You don't really do drugs, but you did LSD.
Well, this is back in the 60s.
Right, when everybody was doing it.
Yeah, and it was very...
Does it really change your mind? I've never done it.
Well, I didn't do it to get high. In fact, when I did it, you know, when it was introduced to me, Rachel Estrick... I was at a party, and I was at a party with, and when I walked in, a friend of my sister and me, Carol, she was giving a little gathering at her house in the Greenwich Village, on Houston Street or Houston Street, as I recall. It was a very hot, muggy day that day, and I left the subway, got out of the subway, walked to the loft where Carol was living with her girlfriend. And as I recall, I remember approaching the building, and out of this cab came this redheaded lady, and she went into that same building. She went up before me, and I stayed back because I didn't want her to think that I was somebody trying to accost her. And then finally I went upstairs, and I was Carol greeted me, introduced me to Rachel. And Rachel took a liking to me for some reason. The place was filled with all of these ladies, but they were all gay. Perfect.
Oh, damn.
And I was the only guy there. It was really,
but you were so smooth.
It was so interesting. It was so interesting to me. Yeah. You know? But anyway, there were a couple of gay girls who really kind of really took to me. But Rachel took to me. So anyway, she ended up giving me a cup of tea. And I had no idea what was in the tea. And before I knew it, I was hallucinating. And it was one of the most extraordinary moments. But it was one of those moments I always felt it was meant to be, you know. Right. And then the following day. I don't remember. But it was, I had to go to a funeral. And I was partly on LSD when I went to the funeral.
What was that like?
Very spiritual, because I had a very, very beautiful spiritual experience. I mean, I suddenly was in touch with myself in a way that I never dreamed of and needed to be, because there was a lot of confusion at that point in my life.
Yeah.
About who I was, where I was, why I had success on Broadway at a very early stage in my life. And all of a sudden, I didn't have the success that I thought was going to go on and on and on. So it was a very confusing moment. But that LSD...
grounded you?
But it wasn't just LSD. It was I was embracing Eastern philosophy, Buddhism, European Western philosophy. I was getting into a whole world through Rachel Esrick. We ended up living together. I started getting into a whole world that I had not anticipated as a result of this relationship I had with this woman. And she was quite an exceptional person.
Wow.
She was extraordinary.
So it did change your life in a way.
It changed my life, yes.
Wow. It always scares me. That's why I've never done it.
Listen, when you go out to Jones Beach and you're sitting in a little cluster of a bush talking to the flies, you know, having a communing with the flies. you know that you've arrived.
You have arrived. Can you look back and say, I did it my way. I'm happy with the way things work.
Frank Sinatra.
I mean, do you feel like, because some people would say, oh, I wish I would have done this. I
always wanted to ask Paul Anka, who wrote the song. I said, you were a kid. How in the hell did you write this? How did you come up with this whole thought process? I did it my way. I mean, only an old guy would, it sounds right for an older guy to really understand that.
Right.
But here was a kid, a young man who wrote this thing, and I always wanted to ask him, well, how did he do that?
Yeah, you haven't lived your life. How do you know you're doing it your way? You're doing it your way in the first 25 years. Oh, my gosh. I have to ask about this real quickly is, you know, the Colt 45 commercials, because, like I said, smooth. Those are one of those things that you did for 5 years. Sales burst through the, once you started doing it, everybody started drinking it.
It works every time.
I mean, how do you turn a product like Colt 45 into the coolest thing ever?
Because it was so much fun. It was the whole idea of it. The whole idea of being a spokesperson that had lines like, don't let the smooth taste fool you. Or it works every time. I mean, it was like the book, the title. And that was what I said to Princess Leia. You know, hello, what have we here? You know, I mean, that kind of stuff just becomes like playing a chord.
You loved it.
Yeah.
Do you think you got more women when you did that? More people, more, even more women were attracted to you after that?
Oh, the women, they love me to death. Oh, my goodness gracious.
So back to that question, you have no regrets.
You have women fainting.
No.
Oh, yeah. I was like a rock star. You'd have a situation where they would rent out, if I had to go promote something, they would have to rent out the main floor of a department store. Women, wall to wall, had brought in by bodyguards, and having women literally in your face, right in front of you, just go pew, straight to the floor. People bringing their babies for me to touch their babies. I mean, if I was a preacher,
Billy D. Jesus.
Yeah, I would have been Billy D. Jesus. Yes.
Billy D. Jesus.
I'm serious. This is what I was living for a big part of my life.
This has been an absolute joy. I mean, really.
Well, thank you so much.
I mean, yeah, I've wanted to get you here, and I'm amazed that you showed up. I was like, you know, he's supposed to be here tomorrow. I think he's coming today. But you're an icon, and I've learned so much from this. Believe it or not, you've taught me a lot. It just being and you know, letting go and not getting caught up in the minutiae or the bullshit. And, you know, I appreciate you.
Well, I appreciate you. Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Very kind of you.
Now, can you sign my Lando Calrissian thing?
Absolutely.
Yes! This is the best day of my life. You couldn't ask for a better guest.
I mean...
Were you excited?
That was so cool.
Were you nervous?
Probably not as nervous as you, because I just had to sit there and pretend to make notes.
I guess so.
I take notes.
Yeah.
But, no, he looked sharp. He was with it. He sounded sharp. His
87? 80, going to be 87 or something like that? He says it in the interview, but...
I mean,
he looked great. He
a
just
blazer in a pocket square.
Genuinely happy. Yeah. Genuinely happy. And he really he brought it.
He
brought it. So thanks, Billy D. Thank you guys all for listening again. If you like the podcast, please follow us and subscribe. You can watch on YouTube. You can listen most everywhere. And if you want to join Patreon, patreon.com/insideofyou and support the show, we could use your help. And the top tiers of the patron get a shout out. And here they are. And I love each and every one of you, starting with Nancy D. I'll see you soon. Leah and Kristen. I haven't heard much from them. Little Lisa. Always hear from Little Lisa. Yukiko. Miss you, Yukiko. And Jill E. Jill E., you've been around for ages. You're awesome. Brian H, OMD, baby. Nick, Nico P, and Zachary. Sweetest guys alive. Robert B. Robert. Jason Dreamweaver and Sophie. Hi, Sophie M. How are you, Sophie? Always great to see her at a con. And Raj C and Jennifer N and Stacy L, Jamal F. Come on. These guys are old school, man. You guys are the veterans of Inside of You. Janelle B, of course. Mike E, El Don Supremo. Dan, where are you? 99 more. I mean, 99 more has been here from the beginning, too. I mean, Santiago M, of course. Love him. Leanne P, what a great supporter. We love you. Maddie S, Maddie's been here. All these people, Belinda N and Dave Ho and Brad D. Gotta love my Brad D and my Ray H and my Tabitha T. Ah, Tom N, Talia M, Talia and Tommy, and Betsy D. Ryan, why don't you say a few names that you remember?
Rhiannon C, Corey K,
yes.
Dev Nexon,
Michelle A,
Jeremy C,
Jeremy,
Mr. M,
mm.
Eugene and Leah, Eugene and Leah. Mel S, Mel. Christine S, yes. Eric H, Shane R, Andrew M, Oracle.
Amanda R, Kevin E, Stephanie K. I mean, these names, I just love these guys. Jarrell, Jammin' J, Leanne J, Luna R, Mike F, Stonehenge, Brian L, Jules M, Jessica B, Kyle F, Kaylee J, Kaylee and Kyle and Jessica, Brian A, Marion Louise L, Romeo the Band, Frank B, Jen T, April R M, Randy S, Oral P, Rachel D, and can't forget Melissa H, Nick W, Stephanie and Evan, Charlene A, Don G, Jenny B, John, Jennifer R, Tina E, NG, Tracy, Tasha S, Keith B, and Waffles. I couldn't do it without you guys. You know this, and thank you from the bottom of my heart. From Michael Rosenbaum here in the Hollywood Hills of California.
I'm Ryan Tejas. I'm here too.
Ryan Tejas, a little wave of the camera. We love you guys. I really mean it. Thank you for all the support and love. And thanks for staying with me, sticking with me, sticking with this podcast. Thank you, Bryce. Thank you, Jason. Thank you, Ryan. Thank you to all my guests. And just remember, be good to yourself. I'll see you next week.
The Rolling Stone Music Now podcast gets inside the biggest stories with Rolling Stone senior writer Brian Hyatt.
Now here is my conversation with Jacob Knoll. Your story is an amazing one, and obviously you lost your dad when you're only 1 year old.
It was definitely a screwy way to grow up. I think that a lot of people never heard of who I am, and then they see me join this band, and they must think this kid must have just handed everything, or nepotism kid. It's a gift that I have an opportunity to sing in such a big band like my father and my uncle's band, Sublime.
Rolling Stone Music Now, wherever you listen.